Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Dr. Barbara Fredrickson, professor of psychology and director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Lab at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, joins us now. She's the author of a new book, Love 2.0, How Our Supreme Emotion Affects Everything We Feel, Think, Do, and Become. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fredrickson.
Oh, it's good to be here, Brian.
So first of all, what is Love 2.0, and how do you distinguish it from love 1.0?
Good question. I think, you know, most of us, you know, tend to view love and romance in the same breath, and I think that's far too restrictive. And we can think about love sort of in different perspectives by looking at how it's affecting our health, how it's affecting our ability to grow and change over time. And the kinds of love that matters are these micro moments of connection. Micro moments of connection you can have even with people you just met. You can have them with your soulmate too, but you can also, you can have them in good times and bad, and just those moments when you feel like you, you know, meet eyes with someone and really connect, kind of sharing a mutual care. Those moments we find tend to be particularly potent in terms of promoting health.
Why focus on these micro moments, as you call them, which, as you say, you can even have with a stranger who you just met, rather than on the deeper bonds of love that you might have with your spouse or your partner, but also with your parents or your children or your friends?
Right. And these micro moments actually relate to those deeper bonds. I think they're what create those deeper bonds, that those deeper bonds reflect our past history of these kinds of moments.
So a person could have one of these loving connections anywhere, at home, at work, in the store. Describe the physiology, because I guess that's what you study, if you're relating this to physical health.
Right. There's reason to believe that with these moments of connection, there's a biobehavioral synchrony that unfolds across two bodies and brains at once when two people are connecting like this. Our brain activity begins to mirror one another, our gestures, our neurochemistry as well, our biochemistry as well. And in a way, it challenges the idea whether this love as an emotion belongs to one person, or is it really something that's happening across two brains and bodies at once?
Can you tell us a story? Tell us about a particular instance that you write about?
Sure. You know, one of the great examples of this comes from a former student of mine who worked for Teach for America, and he was facing a really difficult challenge with a group of 12 really learning challenged kids who were just completely disengaged. And he realized that, you know, I learned about this positive emotion stuff back in college, and maybe I could apply some of that here. And he used ways of introducing positive emotions, even the science of positive emotions. He started talking about that instead of math, and got his students to buy into the idea that if they actually could celebrate each other's successes, they'd all have more collective capacity. And so he really used that to turn around the performance of his class in a really remarkable way. And where TFA, Teach for America, would call that classroom climate, I'm saying that's classroom climate built upon these micro moments of shared positive emotion and connection.
And so that's beyond what we normally think of as love. If you're talking about a positivity resonance, shared moments of positive emotion, these, other than love, they can be joy, they can be optimism, they can be pleasure at hearing a great piece of music. How
exactly.
how broad is this?
It's as broad as every positive emotion. I think the difference is that when you have a positive emotion that you're in the same moment sharing with somebody else, that's a particularly potent emotional experience. It may be far more, may provide far more nutrients for our health than the positive emotions that we feel by ourselves, which we know are really significant. And I just raised the question, it's like, well, if this emotional moment is far more important than other emotional moments, then maybe we should use that really, you know, potent word, love, to describe this shared positive emotion connection.
Listener,
so whether you call it love or not, it's still a really a potent mind-body experience.
Listeners, any positive resonance for you from this conversation or a question you might have for Barbara Fredrickson, Dr. Fredrickson from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, her new book, Love 2.0, How Our Supreme Emotion Affects Everything We Feel, Think, Do, and Become, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. I don't know if you get to anything remotely political in this book, but Martin Luther King used to preach about love in his advocacy of civil rights and ending inequality, also the Vietnam War. Today it would be considered quaint, I think, to talk about love in the context of politics like that. Have you read any King or thought about anything like this?
You know, that's a great question. I do think that I don't really get into political in this book, but I do make some connections to, you know, spiritual phenomenon of oneness, that sense of feeling connected to something larger than yourself. I think that feeling state is one way that poets and artists and preachers have described this very real psychological, biological moment that we have when we really come to act as one with others. And so what Martin Luther King may have been referring to there is this same idea of, like, there are certain moments when we feel ourselves to be part of something larger. And these moments of positivity resonance, I think, are the bedrock of that.
And yet you advocate for meditation a lot in this book. Meditation is a good thing, no question, but some people would say that, there's a critique of meditation as the basis of spiritual growth because it's disconnected from other people, that it might be kind of solipsistic. You know, at the cartoon end, you can sit on top of a mountain and think you've reached enlightenment, but if you're not engaging with other people, you really have no way of knowing.
Exactly. You know, I address that in my book by pointing out that some of the best tools for helping us create more of these moments of positivity resonance with others are solo activities. They kind of pull us out of the action. I call them preparatory. They're preparatory activities that help us have the mindset and the openness and the other focus to be able to connect with others, to kind of break out of our self-absorbed cocoons, if you will, to be able to notice and pay attention and celebrate with others. So I think meditation is a useful tool, and I actually, you know, I've done research on meditation for the last 10 years about, and we've got some pretty remarkable effects emerging from that work. But it's you don't need to stop there. We actually find in the science that the real benefit of the meditation happens off the cushion when you're in the real world and you're connecting with other people differently. That's where the payoff is.
Claudia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Barbara Fredrickson. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm wondering why she conflates the idea of a compassionate response to others with love. I think that those two things seem to be, you know, there's a vast difference between the love one has for a partner and the complexities of that, or one's children or family, and to live a life in which you are mindful and compassionate. I mean, I think compassion is probably the highest form of intelligence. because it requires a great deal of understanding and a capacity to reach out and be caring to other people. But that is not at all, as far as I have in my experience, the same thing as love.
And so, Dr. Fredrickson, what about that critique?
Well, Claudia, I agree with you that compassion is extraordinarily important. And I think the thing to appreciate is I'm trying to look at this from the angle of science, where we use words like love and compassion in lots of different ways, you know, in our kind of ordinary lives. And yet my job as a scientist is to try to understand how they all relate and how each moments of connection between people kind of add up to larger bonds or ways of being in the world or ways of seeing. And actually, what I've argued is that these moments of positivity resonance are one and the same with compassion when we become aware that the other person is suffering in some way. But, you know, compassion could be viewed as a version of love that we feel when we're aware of suffering. And suffering is ubiquitous, so compassion is perhaps, you know, warranted most of the time. Except there are other moments when, you know, the other person may be joyous or experiencing good fortune, and that's, we don't have compassion for them then, but we can still connect. And that's, so I think love comes in many forms, and compassion can be viewed as one form of it. But semantically, you know, it doesn't really matter what words you use to describe these micro moments of connection. Just recognizing their power is the real importance.
We're just about out of time. I'm just curious, since you study meditation, do you compare different types of meditation? We had the producer David Lynch on recently, promoting transcendental meditation, the TM system in particular. Do you compare different kinds of meditation for their physical health effects?
Yeah, we do that now. We started off studying loving-kindness meditation, and now we're comparing loving-kindness meditation and mindfulness meditation. I have yet to do any studies with TM, but...
Do you find any differences physiologically or spiritually, if you can measure that, from the different kinds of meditations you are studying?
That's a great question. We've just done our first study that has the comparison. What we find is that loving-kindness meditation tends to be a little bit easier for novices to take up, that mindfulness meditation is a little more challenging just at the very start. But we're doing our long-term studies right now, looking at changes in gene expression and all kinds of health effects. And so the results of that are still in the future. But great question.
And we will leave it there with Barbara Fredrickson, PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her new book is Love 2.0, How Our Supreme Emotion Affects Everything We Feel, Think, Do, and Become. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. If anyone wants to learn more, the website that has even free guided meditations is positivityresonance.com.
Thanks so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the NAACP and the Hispanic Federation come out against Mayor Bloomberg on supersized sodas. Are they choosing, in the NAACP's case, Coca-Cola financing over black kids' health? Stay with us.
And there's a road in the